You are listening to the Krika Lecture Series podcast, produced by the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This and other Krika podcasts are available on SoundCloud and iTunes. For more information about Krika's lecture series and public events, visit our website at krika.wisc.edu.
To introduce all this.
Yes, thank you, Rina. I think I'm going to do without the mic. So, yes, I'm happy to introduce to my closest friends one of the privilege of doing this is presenting them to you. We met as students in, around 2000 in the Russian State University for the Humanities in GGU, one of the early post-Soviet experiments in liberal education that, along with other more famous ones, have been concluded by now. And we are looking back at that era, and I left follow a path in international academia. Anya Nemzer and Yevgeny Nemkin stayed in Moscow and only left after the eruption of the full-scale invasion in 2022. And in the years or decades in between, they did not only become experts on their particular field that can share expertise, but also witnesses and participants in the Russian liberal public sphere that was obviously shut down after the full-scale invasion after February 2022. But before that, Anya Nemzer and Ilya Benevkin were involved, again, not only developing their expertise, but were involved in different kinds of civic initiatives that and journalistic work that actually constituted this civil society. Anna Nemzer is so they have both a lot of things, they play a lot of roles. Anna Nemzer is a TV anchor, familiar to the audience of the TV channel Dorsk, the most prominent Russian-speaking oppositional TV channel. Anna has also made documentary films and done a lot of research on several things. She made an award-winning film about Galina Staravoitova, a very important post-perestroika Russian politician, an early feminist, a very important figure, underappreciated figure. Anna also has done documentaries on the memories of the Chechen War among the Chechen community, both in Russia and outside Russia, and a film on the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict and the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. So she has researched those topics and has a comparative perspective on a lot of the things that we are discussing now and that current journalism is dealing with. Ilya Vinyavkin is a historian, has a PhD in history. He is a historian of Stalinism originally. That was his initial topic. And right now, again, after the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, he has developed a project on the genealogies of Putinism, leading back to some of the themes that he knows as a historian of Stalinism. For his publications, some of his publications, again, not academic, journalistic publications, have already out, already available online, and they were so good that he was awarded the distinction of being a personal foreign agent by the Russian government. Before that, Ilya was involved in Moscow in projects of civic education, liberal arts education, outside of formal institutions, outside of universities, so private initiatives that offered liberal civic education to adults, to willing audiences. So that was also an important, just coming to Moscow, witnessing that work, I was impressed of how important and crucial it seemed before it was, of course, forcefully and violently shut down. And so today they are presenting their project that they're currently now working while they're based in the US, the Russian Independent Media Archive, which is an online archive that was allow us to work with the archives of Russian independent media. The archives are, of course, in danger because the Russian state has taken control over them, ownership of them, and they will maybe talk about the specifics. But a lot of different topics and issues to discuss. So what will happen now is that I'm going to just give the floor to them, and they won't give a 45 minutes talk each, obviously, right? So Anya will start, right?
Right.
And then Ilya will add, and then we will have a conversation. That is the plan.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this introduction. I'm really flattered, and thank you for sending us here. We've been looking forward to coming to medicine for a very long time. So we agreed that I'll start with a short history of media censorship in Russia. I'll try to make it really short, though it's quite difficult. And Ilya will then follow with the presentation of our current project, the Russian Independent Media Archive. So, first. I tried not to go very deep down in the past, and I tried to frame it somehow. There was the moment around 2010, I think, when there were a lot of independent media, and it's important. I foresee questions about this idea of independence because it's a tough one, it's a difficult one, and definitely it's difficult to draw this line between independence and independence, being dependent and being independent, and so on. But I would say that we know about this problem, and we are trying to make some solutions how we define that. Now Russian state has drawn the line quite visually, because all the independent media are blocked or forbidden or something like that. But I have to say that maybe we can use this definition that when we talk about media independence in case of Russia before the war, it's most correct to mean independence from the agenda that is directly dictated by the media curator from Kremlin. And so the situation is we have around 150 independent media, approximately 70% of them are based in Moscow, 30% in regions. And what's important that all the independent media mostly are not television. And television has ceased to be a platform for free journalism since 2001. And again, I'm not trying to dig into deep past, but it was important, the dismissal of the editors of the NTV channel. And so that was unmutual, not consent, but agreement. You can have your independent media, but not on TV. And 2010 is the year when TV Rain, Телеканал Дождь, was born, and it was actually one exception of this rule with some dramatic consequences. I will be focusing on the history of Dost, of TV Rain, a lot, not because I'm working there and I've been working there for already 10 years since 2014, but only because this case is really symptomatic. So they appeared in 2010 as a young, very bright TV channel about lifestyle, about not only about politics, but about life in Moscow, life in St. Petersburg, everything that is fashionable, everything that is fancy, something like that. And really quick, it actually turned into an oppositional TV channel because the protests in Russia started. And of course, TV Rain was covering them very thoroughly. And so 2000, still it's the only one exception of this rule with TV, non-TV. And 2014, it's of course a great turning point. It's the year of annexation of Crimea. And we have several cases. I won't go deep into the details, but we have several very unpleasant and very symptomatic cases when we realized that the authorities decided to make further repressive steps in their relationships with media. So one of the most horrible moments is the demolition of Lenta.ru, the main independent media news outlet, the media that gave, every day they gave us the picture of the day. It was really important. You would take a look at Lenta website and you saw the whole picture of the day. And there was, I really don't want to go deep into these details, but there was disconnection of the TV rain channel from cable channels. They lost all the advertising revenues. They lost their office, and it was a special repressive campaign, I would say, against TV Rain and against independent media, blocking the most consistent, blocking the most consistent critics of Putin's regime, Grani.ru, Kasparov.ru, Ежедневный журнал, еженедельный, weekly, then daily journal. And so on. And the appointment of Maria Komarova as head of the Kommersant publishing house, she was very close to Kremlin. So that was the turning point when previous scandals, previous local cases of censorship became a tendency, became something, became a huge problem, and we realized that we are dealing with the fight, actually. Next year, next period, 2014-2021, survival mode. Here is the, actually, it's a very, it's a nice picture, and it is really pleasant to look at, to take a look at that, but it's not a symptom, it's again an exception. This is the moment of 2019 when our colleague Ivan Golunov was arrested, and we were absolutely sure that his destiny is already already clear. We were afraid that he would be sent to jail for many, many years. He was accused of keeping drugs and so on. And these were absolutely absurd and false accusations. And this was, I think, the only moment of triumph, because there was a lot of protests and people were out on the streets. And somehow he was released. And this is the moment when two major newspapers went out with this text, Яма Иван Голунов, Жюри Шарли Эбдо, and so on, asked Иван Голунов, I am Иван Голунов. But before that, the process was quite depressing, because major, including these three, Kommersant, Ведомости, РБК, news media majors, became loyal. The editorial teams, the previous editorial teams, either resigned, either they were like thrown away, and so on. They lost their independence. And other media outlets were trying to survive, actually. They, some of them switched to a subscription model to just in order to exist. So they had financial problems, they were struggling. TV Rain, as just an example, also was forced to change to subscription model. And it was nice, because I'm saying it like a person who, like an employee, like a person who worked with this model, because it was really important and good to like to see the direct result of your work, to see people who are willing to pay for your work. But at the same time, of course, the subscription model deprived us of a bigger audience, and we had, well, okay, 70,000, I think, subscribers versus millions that we had like our as our audience before 2014. Oh, 2021, 2022, pre-mortem state, acting like guerrilla fighters. So the most important thing, this law about foreign agents, which already existed for some time, but the authorities used it from time to, have been using it from time to time, just in that cases when they needed it for their repression goals, repressive goals. And since the summer of 2021, this process goes like a snowfall, like, I don't know, it goes, so foreign agents are announced every Friday, and I think I have to say a few words about this foreign agent law, because actually, a person with proper mental health has difficulties with understanding the whole concept. So it's really difficult to explain the whole idea. So first of all, if you are declared a foreign agent, no, let's start from here. An organization can be declared a foreign agent, but also a person can be declared as foreign agent, but also a person can be declared as media foreign agent. And I can't explain that. It's really interesting. Then if you are declared a foreign agent, you have to put this short piece of text, which is called in Russia, well, it's Plashka, or foreign agent Dai, or Ебала. How do I translate it? I'll have to use the F word for that. Yeah, so some words before you have to put it in your in any text you produce, any video you produce, anything, including your Instagram posts, your Facebook, your any posts in your social media, and probably your notes and your messages, and even you, for instance, if you are a parent and you have a child and you're just a part of some parent's chat in WhatsApp and something or something like that, and you're discussing your child's actually issues and something like that, you also have to put there these words. Then the сообщение создано и или распространено, it's some bureaucratic bullshit. Around 40 editorial offices are recognized as foreign agents. 400 people, I was counting a week ago, so I think that maybe more already. 399 was last week, people recognized as foreign agents. 147 organizations have been declared undesirable in Russia. I will have to explain it somehow. It's a very special nomination. I don't know. It was 14 of them were journalistic organizations. Most of them were human rights organizations, universities, other institutions. But if you are undesirable, it's actually the end of your profession. You can't deal with anybody anymore. You just have to cancel all your activities. You have to, I don't know, to make people forget your name. I don't know how it's done, but the idea is approximately this. All your colleagues refuse to work with you. And I had these examples when my colleagues from Project Media were declared, were pronounced, recognized as undesirable. They had a very small editorial team, but they had a lot of freelance authors and other employees who helped them with, for instance, video production. And they all immediately refused just to communicate with them, not even not to work with them, but even to just to discuss anything in messengers, because they were saying it's a criminal case to communicate with undesirable organization. So around 2,000 arrests of journalists while on duty, about 30 criminal cases against journalists. I think you might probably heard about Ivan Safronov accused, they call it treason. Actually, the accusation is based on the fact that he received $248 from some foreign colleague. And about 40 police searches of journalists. And again, I can tell some fairy tales about how all our lives, we all during this period, 2021-2022, we were constantly discussing these searches and these life hacks, how you can, if you have this search, if they came to you in the morning, then you have to hide your phone in cat's litter, because they don't know about the cat litter. And then they say, oh, something new. They know about the cat litter. Don't hide your phone in the cat litter. So something like that. And then 2022. So again, some laws were adopted immediately. Law about fakes, law about the discreditation of Russian army, and so on. So it's actually a military censorship. I can give some examples that my colleagues who managed somehow to operate now in Russia, they gave me some examples of what is forbidden, what is not, and how it's done, and how they operate. But February 2022, military censorship. About 600 journalists left Russia immediately, because, including me, because we didn't see any possibility to keep working. We couldn't even think about following these rules, obeying these orders. And otherwise, it was 15 years in jail. About 30 media continue to operate from abroad. They managed somehow to start over. And since the beginning of the war, Roskomnadzor has blocked 95 information resources operating in Russia or from abroad targeting Russian audience. Yeah. I think, you know, this picture, it's the act of very small and brave act of protest. This is Channel One, and one of the editors, Marina Ovsyannikova, ran in the studio in the middle of broadcasting on air with a poster with words "No War," and there were words "They are lying to you. Don't listen to them. They are lying to you," and so on. And so, life after death—that's something that we are experiencing right now. Those people who managed somehow to leave the country and work from abroad, including TV Rain, which is based now in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, we have to. We are totally deprived of sources in Russia, of course, and it's a very difficult situation, because when we communicate with freelancers in Russia, they have to work undercover, we have to keep them safe, we don't want any risks. There are some possibilities. We can still work somehow. We can still work with databases. We can do investigations. TV Rain's special thing is broadcasting here and now our current news and we have this problem with being here and now, of course, but we are trying to manage that somehow. People who remained obey the laws, and of course they put themselves in danger every day, and they're actually heroes. They are trying to survive and continue to do what's possible in these difficult conditions. And some good news are that there are some newborns. They were already born after the full-scale invasion began, and born abroad. More than 10 new independent media appeared after that. And what we can see, they have, of course, they all have, we all are struggling with financial problems. We all are had to figure something out. The amount of journalistic grants and applications are raised 2 times, 2.5 times, I don't know. But what we can see is that the number of visits to survivors' media websites has increased by 32%. And we see huge increase in social networks. And at some point, it's a good sign. At least we are trying to survive with some idea that maybe people are watching, people are reading, maybe people are listening. I think I realize now that I skipped some points, but maybe I'll make a pause for, that's our last slide, yeah? Okay, I'll make a pause for some Q&A and some questions about these guerrilla fighters mode and how we managed to do that, how my colleagues managed to do that, and the whole question about independence, so we can discuss in this Q&A session, and then I will,
we'll go.
Okay, then Ilya, floor is yours, and Ilya will tell about the second part, what we are doing right now, and then Q&A session. Thank you.
Very short history of Russian independent media fighting censorship, and that's a point where we start our project. I would say that behind that, so we have certain mind maps or certain legacies from our just previous work in Russia, in the sense that we know that very well, the importance of an archive and the importance of memory. And I believe that just on a certain level, we just realizing that some important period in the history of Russian society is over, or there was some radical change. So there was the moment of kind of historical thinking for us. And we started thinking about things that can be lost and the thing that must be preserved. And when we started thinking about the archive of the Russian civil society, so that this legacy is not lost, this experience is not lost, the first thing that came to our mind was the archives of media, because just on some level, just from the Anna's presentation, you can see that just there is very convincing. So if the state is trying to destroy that so hard, maybe there's a reason to preserve that and to fight harder not to let the state do that. On the other hand, so we literally have been witnessing this effort just materialize. So here you can see the scan from the Novaya Gazeta article, and with the brilliant article by Yelena Kostuchenko about Russia's invasion in Ukraine and the reportage from Kherson, the city in Ukraine. And so there was a moment when Novaya Gazeta was trying to obey the laws, and there was military censorship straight away. And so that was, so no, it isn't so, but there was a moment where this newspaper was available on their website, but it was blurred because so they tried to comply with the Russian censorship law. And we know for sure that these processes are going on just sometimes undercover. So there are lots of articles, sometimes even the whole outlets, that are facing different challenges. So sometimes they are economic ones, so editorial teams didn't have funds to pay for the servers. Sometimes, so this is the kind of manual censorship when their team or the media that's trying to operate to talk to a Russian audience knows that in the article, in the archive back then, for example, there's an interview about LGBT issues, and they just go on to erase it manually from their own archive so that they can keep on working and avoid the censorship. And so we feel that just that seems, I would say, rather for us it was important task, but rather evident one, so that we need to preserve what is done. And then we just came up with this idea of Russian Independent Media Archive. And only after we realized the amount of work that is behind this idea of preserving everything, because this digital preservation is sometimes very different from the archival work, and you need to have a lot of expertise, and you need to find a lot of solutions for that. I would say that these are three goals of the project, because so we know that the preservation is only the starting point. Because, I mean, we hope that at some moment we will just accomplish this task of preserving everything that has been published since the year 2000. So we have other ways of developing this project. So the first one, it is preserving. The second one is using the potential of data. And this is the one that is kind of, I would say, a certain type of revolution that's happening just for a decade or so. So we understand that just the archive is not only the collection of articles, but it's a huge data set. So we have lots of research techniques and methods that allow to extract meaning from the data that was impossible to do that before. So I say that I was just a historian of Stalinism, so I just would go to the library to read the Pravda newspaper, just trying to understand the language that is used to talk about salvation and to talk about punishment and forgiveness. But now, just using the language models, I can make the AI read the data set of the newspaper and trying to analyze what was the way of talking about punishment and forgiveness, but just in a digital way. And we're not doing that, but we are providing the infrastructure for the researchers. And so we hope that our mission is not only to spread the articles, but to spread the data so that it can be used for different purposes, being research purposes or activist purposes or journalistic ones. And the third one, just as we were thinking, we somehow coming from this idea of civil society, and we value the idea of just collaboration and solidarity, we think that the task that we have, it is to share the tool that we have just in our project. So our idea is that as we are building the digital infrastructure, so we have the ways of creating the archives, we have our ways of parsing the sites, like collecting just automatically the materials from site to put them in the archive. We now have tools to read the PDFs and transform them just very quickly, to transform hundreds of thousands of PDFs into digital text. So our mission is to share that, just to find like-minded organizations and just groups of people and so on, to try to collaborate them so that they can use the technology that we have maybe to fight censorship in other places of the world or doing some other activities that just we appreciate. So that was the mission. So what we have, so just for us it's important. So we started talking about the archive while it's still a work in progress. So just we still need some time to accomplish at least the first phase of preservation. So now you can visit our website at rima.media and find 44 media outlets and 2 million articles. And just for us it was important just to make that available for people who do not speak Russian. And so just we kind of earlier this month we introduced a feature for this archive to be used fully in English. So we have all the articles automatically translated into English and you can browse the archive without understanding Russian or typing just using Cyrillic. And so we hope that that can be the source just of the information for many people who are interested in understanding modern Russian. We also offer the help with creating data sets. So if you're a researcher or a scholar, just a student, and just you want to do the research, you can apply on our website. Just explain the idea that is behind your project, and we will be happy to provide you with a spreadsheet or just to contain the information that you need. And finally, so we have some future goals. So once again, so they are just at that point rather technical. So we want to kind of be as exhaustive as possible, and we hope to get 140 media outlets by the end of this year. We also understand the importance of adding the video and audio because we have the archive of Tigrayan, and we hope to see it in our collection. So we have the podcast, that is the podcast revolution happening, still happening in Russian media, and we have the iconic radio stations, and we need to get the audio from these sources. And we need to make it searchable. So just once again, we're talking about technical tasks, but to make you use the huge archive of video, we need to just automatically transcribe all the video, transform them into text, connect them to the time codes in the video, and make it possible for you to search through this type of sources. Then just we will go to the archive, this media that's operating it, social media like Telegram and Instagram, and that's once again an important way for this newborn media that Anna was talking about to avoid censorship, because Telegram is still and YouTube, yeah, so they are still the platforms that are not blocked in Russia, and so we see that many outlets in Russia, they kind of deprioritize their website, so they understand that their website is a problem. But social media is their connection to the audience, because we can talk about that. That is, once again, so just in this history of Russian media, that's a huge drama of just hundreds of brilliant journalists who just are trying so hard to get their readers, because they have them inside, but they have lots of barriers to overcome. And we will also try to fine-tune the search engine so that just we can provide the better searching service for you. So if you have an idea, so if you go, so my task is just to spread the word that, so if you visit our website and you see, well, I wanted to see something different happening with my search, so please write an email to me so that you can find the contact, because we are still a work in progress and we are ready and we'll be happy to adapt given the feedback. And then there's another task that is closely connected to the story that Anna was telling. There's the story of the gray zone media, because if we look at the history of Russian media, we see that there's huge number of articles created by the best journalists that is now in the possession of the state-run or kind of semi-state-run media. For example, the archive of Lenta.ru so cannot be legally just obtained by archive, because we will never get the permission from them to have this archive, to have them these materials in our archive. So we are working on the ways to still make it possible for the users to browse these articles through our archive. But then you will need to go to some other sites with the articles. But for us, the task will be just to still to remain the main portal just to understand the Russian media, even though we cannot have the legal possibilities to store these articles. So that's still just, once again, about the difficulty that we face. And so just very soon, we hope that we will just be able to start our first scaling project. So we were happy to meet the journalist from Guatemala. And you know, that's sometimes kind of heartbreaking when you see the journalists from other dictatorships that say, well, oh, I know about this foreign agent law, we have a similar one. So what's the point here at the moment? Oh, we're somewhere around 2017 in Russia. And so we just, so the journalists from unfree countries understand each other quite well, because they share these trajectories, and because the bad thing is that dictatorship, they adapt to you and they learn. So, and in that case, so the thing that that Putin did in Russia is terrible, in the sense that it kind of showed an example for many dictators all over the world what is this way of dealing with civil society. So we hope to start the initiative that will be called a Central American Independent Media Archive. And we'll have the articles from Guatemalan media, Nicaraguan media, and media from El Salvador. And once again, so we understand that there are many countries that can have the similar story, and many journalists with similar needs. And so we just now in the talks and in the search of other communities of journalists who might need this type of work. So we're just talking with journalists from Afghanistan and from Belarus. And just the very last thing in this ideas of just of toolkit is the idea of collecting the archive of the Russian NGOs and human rights group, because we just, if we start if we go back to my starting point, so at the end of the day, so we are thinking about the preservation, not only the media, but the whole legacy of Russian civil society, and so NGOs and human rights group are an integral part of this task. This one, it is just an example of the potential that of the data that we can have. So that's one, that's only a prototype that I'm showing to you. So we are now working on that, and we hope to present that rather soon. So just Anna was just telling the story of Russian censorship using the expert opinions and the lived experience. For us, it was a task to understand what is censorship. So how does censorship look like from the point of view of data? So because so we know that just that there is censorship, for example, so we start like working on the coverage of Alexei Navalny. So that's an easy thing to do. We can trace all the articles mentioning Alexei Navalny easily, so we don't need a sophisticated language model for that. And we need to understand, so what is the difference in coverage between different media? So how differ Russian independent media from the state-run media in covering him? And so just we, at the beginning of the project, we thought that it would have been much easier. We thought that, well, it's obviously that the independent media cover Alexei Navalny a lot and state-run media just silence him. But now we see that this story is a little bit more complicated. And we just, I don't have the slides to present the results because we're still in the process of understanding that. But so now our just idea changed a bit, so because we think that we see that there are some moments when there's kind of public outcry is so loud that the state-run media cannot silence Navalny anymore. So that happened at the moment of his poisoning. So we see that the amount of the mentioning of Navalny doesn't differ a lot from independent and state-run media. And that, I believe that we will be able, just thinking about that, to come up with a more nuanced understanding of censorship in Russia and in censorship under dictatorship, because there's this idea of just correlation between two worlds, like the censorship world and just independent media world and its agenda. But obviously there can be many other ways to understand media through data, or just we can have some insights. So the insight that I had working on the project, like for example, so you can see that this is the mentioning of the names by Russia Today channel. And I thought that Russia Today, the media that is promoting Vladimir Putin, just and saying that he's a great guy. But I mean, if we look at the data, we see that the difference in media that Russia Today, so I'm talking here about the year 2019, that this year that Russia Today promoted Russian athletes. So they were kind of talking about the boxer and about a soccer player. And so that's still kind of, for me, it was a kind of surprise to think about the way that this kind of the agenda differs in that way. So in certain sense, the Russia Today was kind of working on depolitization of the agenda and trying just to present another image the things happening in Russia. So we hope to just, if everything works fine, so I will be happy to just to talk more about this project, but so I would say just in a month or two since today. And that's also this idea to show that, so we are doing that with a huge support from our founders and partners of the Gagarin Center at the Bard College and Pan America, and that's so our just gratitude to Internet Archive projects, of the one that I would say that's just, once again, we are kind of standing on the shoulders of other initiatives, and the Internet Archive is incredible in the effort to just preserve everything. So we have lots of materials lost in Russian web right now that still exist in Internet Archive, and we need to just to do a very careful work in like finding that and bringing that just back. And so we have the support of Mass Media Defense Center and the lawyers, because it's still, well, being just journalists is still legalistic just in modern Russia, and so we need the support. And so we have a partner just about the technology, so the DevBot at a certain point helped us creating this bot that parses the articles from the web. I would say that's just the basic outline of the project that I wanted to give you, and I would say that for us it is still important to be this an open project. I mean, if you find some problem on the website, so please do contact us. So if you have an idea of how that you want to try to use the archive for teaching or for research, so we'll be happy to do that. So now we just are starting the internship with the University of Arizona, and so we are now thinking of how to conceptualize it better, because so we want to see this archive used. There is a newsletter on our website, so if you want to follow the news of the project, you can subscribe. And if you have any ideas, so I'll be happy to discuss that.
Thank you.